Welcome to Limited Time Only.
I'm Esther.
And I'm Susie.
Limited Time Only is the podcast for anyone who feels there aren't enough hours in their life.
And each week, there's a different topic for you to get your ears around.
Featuring chat, comedy sketches, and interviews with interesting people.
Limited Time Only is a pick-me-up in podcast form.
The special guest later in the episode is Andrew Roachford. This week it's time for Nostalgia, the 80s edition, aka the olden days.
Hot dog, jumping frog, Albuquerque, Susie Riddell, we are discussing the 80s today. Woo!
Hot dog, jumping frog, Albuquerque.
I love that song. Do you know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of being a child. It makes me think of little dresses that you would wear that were sort of elasticated at the top and was like little straps, and then that you'd wear as a small child. And it makes me think of the park and the smell of summer days and the hearing tennis balls being knocked on Wimbledon whilst I was in my grandmother's back garden. It's a really nostalgic song for me, that is.
It's a really good one. I think Deacon Blue have been around again. I think I've been touring and stuff, so I've been hearing that one. He's got such a strong Scottish accent that kind of sounds American.
Yes.
And a great voice. Hot dog jumping. I love that.
It's such a good song. So talk to me about the 80s, Suze. What do you think of when you think of the 80s?
I'll happily talk about the 80s for hours.
I know, me too. This could be a long one.
Well, it's just such a... when I think of the 80s, because you said we could talk about the 80s, and I was like, well, what comes to mind? And there's such strong memories of films and television and music, but I don't really remember much. I'm not remembering much about food or what I was really doing because we were just very small children.
Yes.
So there's kind of, it's bright colours, there's big hair, and everyone was bigger than us. everything was really
You're
big.
You're not like my auntie Sheila. She's tiny. I was way taller than her.
Even in the 80s, you were taller than her.
It was because we finished the 80s and we were sort of 11, weren't we? And nearly 12. And I was definitely a tiny little dot. Lovely tiny little petite little thing.
Well, yes, it was primary school. So we started secondary school in 1989.
I did the three-tier system.
So you're middle school.
Primary and middle. But I was supposed to come to your school.
Well, I arranged it so that you didn't. I had a word.
I think that's wise.
I think that's such a shame.
Set your boundaries. It's self-preservation.
No, but it's a shame. I'm sad.
I think it's because my parents realised that they'd have to get up really early to get me in, they couldn't be bothered, so I didn't. But it would have been lovely.
It would have been lovely. But it didn't happen.
No.
And but we're still friends now, so
exactly.
It's probably for the best
part. Yeah.
So when I thought about I think the first things that immediately shot to my brain were films. Films. Because I think they're probably the films I've seen most in my life. Because, we didn't have the choice then, did we? In fact,
no.
We didn't really. I don't feel like I had much choice about what to watch till probably about the last 7 years.
And then you had kids, and then you have no choice.
Oh, God. Well, yeah, that. And also the amount of choice there is now. When we were kids, it was literally four channels.
Yeah.
And you all watched the same films because that was just... how many times did you watch a James Bond?
Well, never. I didn't watch a James Bond until the late 90s and everyone was quite... My dad would always go, I've seen all the James Bonds. So every time they were on, I hadn't seen a James Bond until about 1999. No.
I am absolutely flabbergasted.
I know.
Okay. What about the Indiana Jones trilogy?
Yes.
That was
always on. And I'd
go to
the cinema to see those as well. Yeah. And Indiana Jones.
King Solomon's Mines.
Never seen it.
Stuff like that. Jewel in the Crown.
It's funny, isn't it? Our points of reference, because I've seen that, but only in the last few years, because that's my husband's 80s films. My 80s films are Big, The Goonies, those kind of things. Indiana Jones.
Yes. Well, big, yeah. I was just thinking of the ones that just used to be on telly every holiday.
Yes.
And every bank holiday.
Yes.
Obviously, your parents were, I don't know, it's better that you weren't glued to the box.
Oh, no, I was very much glued to the box. But my, I think a lot of my education through television were things that had happened in the 60s and 70s. So my dad would have me watching things like Dad's Army and Steptoe and Son. And
classics.
But then I would also watch LOLO and stuff like that. But I loved, in the 80s, when there was a film on, oh my God, it was appointment television, wasn't it, as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Because kids' TV was so rarely on. You know, you got a Saturday morning and 3 till 5:30 on a Monday to Friday, and that's about it. And so when it was a bank holiday and it was back-to-back films, it was heaven.
Oh, it was good.
It was good. Heaven.
So the films that stuck, like I wanted to write down, were ones that, and I realised that the 80s was quite obsessed with kind of futuristic, kind of alien paranormal-ish stuff.
Yes.
It's quite a lot going on there. So in year order, this was my list.
Wow.
Starting in 1982.
Yeah.
E.T.
Brilliant.
And then three here from 1984. Ghostbusters, Gremlins and The Neverending Story.
Ghostbusters and Gremlins I've seen so many times. Not really seen Neverending Story. I think I watched it once in the 80s, but I don't really have a memory of it. Don't think
it's a lovely
boat.
One.
Is it?
1985, Back to the Future.
Yes. Oh, yes.
That is a classic.
Absolutely classic.
Labyrinth, 86.
Yeah, my kids had an obsession with Labyrinth when they were little. Yeah.
My kids love that. And it's freaky.
Yeah. And we often walk around the house going, you remind me of the babe. What babe? The babe with the power. What power? The power of voodoo. Hoodoo. You do. What remind me of the babe?
It's so brilliant. I've watched it again recently. And Top Gun, 1986.
Yes. Cocktail.
Oh, yeah.
But I wasn't watching those at the time.
No, this is the thing. I can't. I have a memory of going to the cinema with my dad to see E.T. And I remember sobbing at the end and my dad turning to me and fishing around for a hanky. He always had a hanky. Hanky in his pocket and handing it to me going, oh, Jesus Christ. But whether I've made that up, I don't...
No, you haven't. And I know you haven't because I Googled this once because I'm that way inclined.
You Googled I went to the cinema with my dad.
But I went to see E.T. in the cinema and I thought, I don't think I would have gone when it came out. And it was re-released when we were 7. I think it's when we were 7. So
yes!
You did go to... And I did the same. And I had to fight so hard because I am a crier, as we've established.
Yes.
But
especially when you've had a sherry.
Yeah, and I start singing about girth. I am a crier, but I'm also quite embarrassed about being seen vulnerable. So I'm being seen in a vulnerable way. So I remember really trying to hide my tears, but really finding it. And I actually remember watching it one Christmas at my aunt's house when my parents split up. I went to my aunt's house for Christmas one year instead, which was very bizarre. But I remember us watching E.T. and we were all sat in the lounge and oh my God, lump in the throat that I was swallowing down was absolutely, it was so, I was just like, I will not cry. But God, it's so hot. Even now, now I'm just a mess.
I could,
when I watch E.T.
But I'm so glad you Googled that because I looked at, I was like, 82? There's no way I'd have been taken to the cinema to watch that. So yes, my dad must have taken me when I was 7.
Yeah, oh, little, it's sort of mid-80s it was re-released, put back in the cinemas, and so we went then, yeah.
Oh, that's so great.
Yes.
And Back to the Future, an absolute classic. It's kind of shaped all of us, except my husband, Joel, who is 9 years younger than me. And just before we got married, I discovered that he'd never seen Back to the Future.
What?
I know.
That
how
is ridiculous.
Even
how? Why the hell did you marry him? That's a massive red flag.
It was too close to the date for me to do anything about it.
Yeah,
I mean, I did look into how much it would, you know, how much I would have lost if we cancelled the booking, but...
and an annulment. I mean, yeah, you've committed that money. You might as well just commit the rest of your life.
Well, what I did was just sit him down and make him watch it.
Yeah,
Which kind of solved it. But the Marty McFly, Daddy-O, and Calvin Klein.
Yes. Nobody calls me chicken.
Oh, I just love it.
It's and so then, good.
And Doc.
Yes.
61 gigawatts. Whatever he says. I never quite knew what he says. And the Libyans.
Yes, yes, yes.
Terrible Libyans.
The terrible Libyans.
Everyone, all the baddies were Libyans in those days.
And do you remember as well that in this was probably 90s actually, but I loved Only Fools and Horses so much. In fact, we were saying the other day we need to show the kids. They have seen some Only Fools and Horses, but we said we must, you know, show you some more because they're so, I mean, they're timeless. They're so good.
Oh, yeah.
But in fact, it was the 90s. They did those three episodes and one of them was like Back to the Future, but it flashed forward that Damien had taken over the world. And,
yes.
And that was like Back to the Future 2. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I hadn't realised, I mean, when I looked at the dates, I hadn't realised that they were out in the 80s. They all came out in the 80s. Yeah, I thought, I don't know, I just, it seemed too long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, the other thing I thought of, oh no, do you want to tell me your films?
Oh, well, I've kind of got a few films, but I've just, the things I've written down are sort of a bit bizarre. I've literally wrote down as many things I could think of from the 80s. I can read it out to you if you want.
You can. Right, everybody, settle down.
Okay.
Maybe pause it. Get a cup of tea. Sit down. And you're going to let Esther's memories wash over you. Immerse yourself in the 80s culture. And, I mean, there might be some smells going off here.
Yes.
I mean, there certainly are where I'm sitting. And so I'm ready. I'm shutting
okay,
my eyes.
Some of these are actually sort of, I mean, I feel like we need some of the love story music that Simon, what's-his-face used to do. Yes, the love story. Or do, 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 do,
do, do, do, do. That's what I was trying to sing, but
But I loved your version.
Thank you. It was the wrong key.
Okay, so I've got Smash Hits.
Oh,
Kay's,
yeah.
Kay's Catalogues. Littlest Hobo and Juliet Bravo.
Nicholas Turbo?
Littlest Hobo.
Oh, Little. I thought you said Nicholas Turbo.
I was like, just a guy at school I fancied. The Littlest Hobo. Crackerjack and the Crankies. Oh, I Could Crush a Grape.
Yeah.
Garfield. Pink Panther and Grandstand. I used to hate the music to Grandstand, and I'd always be eating salt and vinegar crisps and some Edam at my grandma's house.
Sorry.
You are a whiz.
Bad memories.
You are
Sorry.
A whiz. Yep. Dog Tanyan.
Yep, the Three Musketeers.
141 and 141. 80 Days Around the World, which never, ever ended. Christopher Biggins in a game where he was, it was like a jungle game and people used to drive around in little safari.
Yes.
And I don't remember what it was.
Yes.
Tammy Girl.
Yes.
Commodore 64.
What's that?
A computer.
Oh, I do.
I used to play Pac-Man on it.
I was thinking of the Commodores.
Oh, no, but classic band. Rackham's in Birmingham. I used to love going to Rackham's and I used to skip round the department store and pretend I was in the yellow brick road. New Kids on the Block, Bros, Grange Hill, Playing the Recorder, which we all had to do, and I always mimed because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Sitting on benches when you were in the upper school, which meant that, you know, you didn't have to sit on the floor with the plebs. Scratchy Trace Paper Loo Roll. What was that about?
Oh, God.
Do you remember that awful toilet paper that you used to have to wipe yourself with?
In every school.
Awful.
It's not at all remotely absorbent.
No.
Smearing pee around your bits.
And it just hurt.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's even worse if you're a girl and you've got to, you know, go around your lady bits.
Yes.
Gin reading books, Tricolour books.
Yeah.
La Rochelle, yes. Covering your school books with wrapping paper.
Yeah.
Which we all did. Young Doctors, Sons and Daughters, Neighbours, Home and Away. Button Moon, Box of Delights, Kenny Everett, Rainbow.
In the worst possible taste.
Yeah. Mr. Ben, Pigeon Street, Why Don't You, Danger Mouse, the 1986 Hurricane, Gingham Dresses, I had a Star Wars lunchbox, hated it. My dad chose it for me because I've never watched Star Wars, and I wanted a girly lunchbox, but my favourite colour was red, so he bought me one with Darth Vader on, and I spent every lunchtime hiding it and scratching Darth Vader off the front.
That's a horrible lunchbox.
It's awful. I was so devastated, and I didn't want to appear ungrateful, but I just felt enormous shame and sadness for a long time about that lunchbox. Yes, as school discos, family weddings in the 80s, where you'd all do ups upside your head.
Yeah.
I mean, no seat belts in the back of the car, so you could get in the boot. And people used to do a lot of sticking their tongue out. Or do you remember when people used to sort of scrunch their nose up at you to snitch their nose up at you to say that they didn't like you? People would walk past you.
No, they never did that to me, Esther. No, I think that was just you.
Just me. And people going, I'm telling.
Yeah.
And I remember once saying, God, and Christopher Riley said he was going to tell on me, and I was about six. And I didn't sleep for a week because I thought I'd send something really awful, and nothing ever came of it. But I was awful. Yeah, it was awful. Pixie boots, shell suits. I mean, there's more, but I mean, this is quite a long list, and this will be turned into a boring episode.
Well, it's nice because every time you said something, you know, the image shot into my head.
We interrupt this programme with a U-bash. As the Calvin Harris song says, it was acceptable in the 80s. It was acceptable at the time. However, unlike the Calvin Harris song, I've got love for you if you were born in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s or noughties. Indeed, I've got love for you whenever you were born. But not in that way. That was only acceptable in the 80s. Goodbye.
I'm not going to do the same because I haven't written that many things down. It's not boring. It was lovely. I've clumped together. I realised that there was a lot of puppets in the 80s.
Yes.
So we've got Rod Hull and Emu.
Yes. Oh, do you know, my aunt worked at Hagley Hall and she used to have lots of celebrity guests there, and Rod Hull and Emu came along, and Rod Hull fancied her friend and used to send her flowers, loads of flowers, but didn't like my aunt, and Emu used to attack her every time. he would get Emu to attack my aunt and then chat up her friend Tonya. Yeah,
that is so funny. I think he was quite weird, wasn't he?
He was weird. And yeah. Grot bags.
Yes, grot
bags.
I had
nightmares about grot bags.
I actually worked with her.
Did you?
A bit later on. Yeah, she was in a radio drama I did when I was about 11 or 12.
Wow.
With Sarah Smart, I think. Me and Sarah Smart and Grot Bags.
Carol, okay, so you got, I think is her name.
Yeah, she was very nice. Yeah, she wasn't green.
No, surprising.
Yeah. Rod Hull and Emu. So we've got Rod Hull and Emu. Keith Harris and Orville.
Yeah.
Basil Brush.
Yeah.
Roland the Rat. Roland Rat.
Yeah.
Who I actually had a bit of a crush on. Yeah, I know, but...
I feel that some of your crushes are a bit bizarre.
Yeah, that's an understatement. I fancied a puppet rat.
What was it about him?
I think he was just he was a bit of a bad boy. Okay, they've come to take me away. All right. It was very nice meeting, very nice knowing you. The straight jackets come out. Jim and Ted Rogers and Dusty Bin, 321.
Yes, I do, yeah.
Now, I mentioned this to Joel, going back to Joel, again, born 1987. He went, Dusty Bin? Was he a musician? And I was like, no, he was a bin.
Oh, this must be quite a depressing aspect of your relationship.
It was very funny. Was he a musician? No, he was a bin. He's called Dusty Bin. We all tried to do the 3-2-1, which I still can't do. I was doing it walking through the train station the other day because I was thinking about this. And I always end up doing the V's.
Yes, yes, yes.
You've got to start the right way round.
Yeah.
Okay. What are the things? I was thinking about toys, Cabbage Patch Kids, My Little Pony, Care Bears.
I had a glow bug. Do you remember glow bugs? I used to love those.
Yeah, I still got one.
Have you?
Yeah, I've got all of My Little Ponies and the mat. And my daughter plays with them, and they still smell quite nice.
Oh, I got bought a My Little Pony for my 40th. My daughter ordered one for me because when I was little, a girl I was at school with stole mine, and my mum then bought me a new one, but it wasn't the same one. I got Applejack, but it was cotton candy was stolen. So on my 40th birthday, one of my gifts was cotton candy.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It's really cute, isn't it?
Well, I've got the only Care Bear I've got is Birthday Bear, which I got for my 8th birthday, kind of like full size one.
Yeah.
One you can cuddle. And I've started cuddling it in bed.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I do think there is something wrong with me. It's quite a chunky, solid, soft toy. So it's quite good as a sort of extra pillow, kind of for leaning your... Yeah.
Whatever.
I just like cuddling. There's something... Yeah. I've regressed.
Yeah, there is something lovely about cuddling a teddy bear, though. It's cute. I totally understand that. And I do get it, you know, if ever I pick up one of my kids' old teddies and I hold on to it, I think, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
but
it's
nice. I was really gutted because there's a theme here, but I really wanted a Care Bear and I wanted a girly one, but I got a blue one and I got a grumpy bear. And I was really pissed off about that as well.
Oh, Esther.
Look, I really wanted a nice, like, you know, I wanted some girly things, but I often got
the pink one with the two hearts.
Yes. Yeah, or something, but I often got bought things that were...
For a boy. Did your dad actually want a boy?
Actually, that's not a joke. He genuinely wanted a boy.
Oh.
But he got me and I'm fabulous, so I'll just have to put up with me. He got two girls. We've got different mothers, but he got two girls. But he did want a boy. I think he just wasn't really aware. He just was probably just went in and picked... I can't imagine my mum chose the Care Bear for me. So he must have just picked one up when I was at work in Birmingham.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was the
Yeah,
the
I just wasn't paying
one.
Attention. Yeah.
The two other things I thought of were quiz shows or sort of show like Wogan, Parky.
Yeah.
I mean, they're Wogan, Parky, Blanky Blank. No, Blankety Blank. Bullseye.
Les Dawson was so brilliant.
So funny.
He was so funny. And I used to love watching the two Ronnies.
Oh, yeah.
And I was terrified of the Phantom Raspberry Blower of Old London Town. Do you remember that? Spike Milligan wrote it and it was, and he'd go around and he'd kill people by blowing a giant raspberry and it was all sort of Dickensian.
Yes.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, yeah. They were so good. And Cannon and Ball and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Kind of good. And then music, I was like, right, I'm just going to, things like Madonna, Aha, Wham, Queen. And the song really, I was like, Tainted Love.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so 80s. And then I was remembering that song that Mark Arman did with Gene Pitney. Something's gotten hold of my heart, keeping my soul and my senses apart. And I listened to it and it was, and I was reminded how quite comical. I mean, there's probably some massive Gene Pitney fans listening, but he's got quite an unusual delivery.
He has.
And so, and there's the line that goes, Scarlet for me, Scarlet for you. And I tried to sing it in karaoke once. I mean, we're talking like the 2000s here. And it's actually really, really hard to sing that song, partly because it's a duet. but it's quite tricky and it's quite an unusual pitch for me. And I remember sort of getting halfway through and just going, oh, sod off, Gene Pitney.
Did you? In the middle of while you were doing karaoke?
Yeah, because I just couldn't sing it. And I got really cross with Gene Pitney.
Well, I don't think Gene Pitney can sing it either, because do you remember there was a clip of him on This Morning? And then he was miming and it all went wrong and he was just sort of stood there. Have you seen that clip?
No.
Yeah, it's Gene Pitney. I think it was that song. Might be wrong, but it was definitely Gene Pitney. And then just all the sound went and everything, and he was just sort of stood there, and it was all out of time and really awkward.
Oh no, that's excruciating.
Yeah.
Oh, Gene, I take it all back.
Yeah,
but it was
keep
the Scarlet for me. hey, something's gotten into my life. So
I think what this sort of chat about the 80s is revealing is that we've both got a lot of issues. you like to cuddle teddies. You've got a crush on a rat. I obviously feel this sense of loss that I didn't get the toys I wanted. We've both got quite a lot of issues.
Brought some things out that I never knew that about you and the being bought sort of sad boys' toys. And I actually did once give Roland a little kiss, like I had a Roland the rat toy.
Did you?
I think my brother and I both had one, and I did give it
with
a little snog. Well, he didn't have a tongue.
No, so, but did you?
No, I don't think.
Him?
I don't think I did. I don't think I knew tongues were involved in kissing. Like, I used to snog Morton Harkett, my Morton Harkett poster. But, well, I have mentioned this before on the podcast. I've got very strong memories of snogging. But it was just, you know, like push my face. I didn't tongue the poster.
No.
And I still find the fact that tongues are involved quite weird.
It's when you really think about it. I mean, I don't find it odd. And then if you really stop and think about it, I remember snogging things. I remember snogging things a lot when I was this kid, trying to work out what you did and imagining what your first kiss would be like. And I remember I was, I really had a very unfortunate looking face in my 80s. I was really cute up until about, 10.
And then your dad drew a moustache on you.
And then I just had a really thick fringe that I grew out. And so I had this like awkward fringe that flopped in my face. And I was just like not very, I mean, my husband said, you can't have been that bad.
But then
I showed him a photo and he went, there were some boys that called me monkey face. And I had this boyfriend briefly, called Robin Harris, and he was considered one of the cool boys, and then his mates made him dump me because they said I was too ugly to go out with. But we used to play kiss chase, and I used to run so slowly, desperate for someone to kiss me, and not one bugger ever did.
This has turned into quite a tragic tragic set of recollections. I know, you know, my dad kind of going Jesus Christ when I was crying. So if anyone has been affected by listening to this episode of Limited Time Only, please contact Dusty Bin on 321. And I was just thinking actually about kissing and stuff. And my little boy, who's 5, will say, let's do a smoochy kiss. It's just so cute. Because they do just sort of turn their heads, and you know, my daughter does it sometimes as well, but absolutely adorable. And I'm like, so down for the smoochy kissing with my 5-year-old.
I know, they do, don't they? I remember my two doing that. They don't do it anymore, they're 17.
Oh, no, that would be
15, so that would be weird.
Okay, so today, I am going to listen to Something That's Gotten Hold of My Heart quite loud and sing along. And I'm
going to go and buy myself a Care Bear that I really want.
Yeah, I'm going to get you a lunchbox with
a girly one.
Cindy on it or something. And I might wear some shoulder pads.
Oh my God, thinking about Cindy, I remember wanting a Cindy doll for my birthday. My little tiny auntie Sheila bought me one, and it was a ballerina one. It's a ballerina Cindy, and literally just bent her leg as you're supposed to. Plastic shot out of her leg, and she was sort of...
Oh, she had like a broken, like a horrible protruding, broken bone.
I think I'm really unearthing some issues
here. Well, I've got a sad... I'm sure everyone's got a sort of sad toy story, because I'm very much the sort of parent who, if my kid breaks a toy accidentally, I'll probably immediately buy them another one. This is why I haven't got any money. But I remember my mum buying me a pair of slip-on high heels. And I must have been very young, because we were in a house that we weren't in for very long. I think I was only about 5. And we got them home. I tried them on, and almost immediately the heel snapped off.
Oh,
and I never had another pair. Never got another pair.
No.
And that's...
You didn't
still
in the 80s. It was tough love.
Tough love.
It was tough love in the 80s. You know, you didn't get these things. And if you went to bed, you went to bed. You weren't allowed down, you know. There was no messing around.
No messing around.
If you missed tea, you missed tea.
No.
If you broke something, it was gone. That was it. Forever.
And you weren't a boy. You were...
Yeah.
Bloody well.
You were bought by
boys' toys anyway.
Right, off for some therapy then, Sue.
See you later. Back to the future.
Welcome to Wicker's World with me, Alan Wicker. My voice sounding like a mixture of David Attenborough and me, Alan Wicker. As we navigate the globe exploring different exotic continents, this week we venture a little closer to home. but fortunately not too close to my home, to the Midlands and the Black Country. Here we meet prolific TV quizzing sisters Beverly Cleverly and her sister Cheryl Fernandez-Vassini. We join them backstage, where Cheryl prepares to be one of the contestants on Blind Date.
Oh, I'm so nervous, Beverly. My palms are sweating. Those fish paste sandwiches are repeating on me, and I've got Too Shy Shy by Kajagoogoo going round me head on loop.
Deep breath, Cheryl. Just remember why we're here. We're here to get you over Dudley Darrell, meet Cella, and bag you a rich fella. And the man who's asking your questions is apparently super rich and called Charles.
But what if it all goes wrong, Beverly? What if I can't speak? What if my lines come out all front to back, all piggledy-higgledy? What if it happens again?
Cheryl, you need to calm down, love. Focus. Yes, things have gone wrong on quiz shows before, but this is a brand new experience.
But the Price is Right, and the Generation Game, and Dusty Bin. It was all so humiliating.
Yes, you fell down the stairs and knocked that man's toupee off his head when Leslie Crowther called, "Come on down." Yes, your wraparound skirt got caught in the conveyor belt on the Generation Game, resulting in Larry Grace and having to cover your modesty.
People still shout, "Shut that door," at me when I walk down the street.
And yes, on 3-2-1, you annoyed Ted Rogers by giving him the finger twice.
I tried so hard not to swear, Beverly. I practiced for ages. He told me where to stick Dusty Bin.
But look how good you were on Going for Gold. You saw off Poland in that final round when no one thought you could.
Henry Kelly did say my knowledge about Engelbert Humperdinck's favourite hair products was better than anyone he'd ever met, and he hadn't even asked me about it.
Exactly. People don't remember the mishaps.
Eyebrows Linda from next door does. She watches my clips on her Betamax all the time.
Come on, let's get you over Dudley Darrell and bag you this rich fella. Let's practice the answers to the questions Charles is going to ask you. Question one.
I'm really into the arts. What sort of arts are you into? And what sort of artistic journey do you think we could go on together?
Go on, say the answer.
New York, London, Tipton, Munich. Everybody talk about pop music. And if you fancy making some sweet, sweet music with me, Charles, then come on down to Tipton and I'll show you a good time.
I think you need to be a bit sexier with it. Oh. A bit breathier. And don't say Tipton, say Litchfield. Sounds more exotic.
Hello! Are you practising the questions from Charles?
Oh my God, you're Cilla Black.
Haven't you heard he's had to pull out because of a polo injury? We've had new questions now from his replacement, Darrell from Dudley. Not Dudley Darrell, he's my ex. Surprise, surprise, the unexpected hits you between the eyes. Oh, I could crush a grape.
Suze, can we start the meeting now? We've been sat here for 20 minutes.
Sorry, I can't decide which of my Bright Disposition notebooks to use. Do I want to dream big and go for my dreamy navy blue notebook? Or do I want to shine bright with a notebook in luscious bright pink? LTO colours.
They're beautiful, but why have you got five?
They all made me so happy I had to buy the full range. Plus, I'm down with the company ethos. Bright Disposition is a small family business and each notebook has been designed with love.
Let me have a look.
Here you go.
Oh, a hard-wearing cover. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous colours. A lovely band to keep them shut.
Yeah.
A ribbon to keep your place.
And top quality paper that my pen glides over and doesn't seep through. I think I'm in love. Okay, I'm feeling sunny, so I'm going for the sky blue. We can start the meeting now, Esther. Esther.
Oh, sorry. I'm just on Etsy ordering stationery from Bright Disposition. There's an LTO discount code for 10% off. I'll be with you in a mo.
No rush. I'm stroking my notebooks.
Bright Disposition. Uplifting gifts to encourage and inspire you. Available from Etsy. And for LTO listeners, there's 10% off. Just use the code LTO10 at checkout. If Susie and Esther haven't bought them all already. Mum, there's another big box from Bright Disposition here.
Hello? It's actual Roachford! Hello,
hello,
so lovely to meet you.
Lovely to be here, lovely to be here.
This week's guest is Andrew Roachford, best known to us all as the music sensation and man behind the band Roachford. Andrew is a singer-songwriter and musician who shot to fame in the late 1980s with his anthemic single, Cuddly Toy. He has toured with Terence Trent D'Arby, The Christians and INXS, to name but a few, collaborated with Beverly Knight, enjoyed his own successful solo career, become one of the lead singers of Mike and the Mechanics, and been awarded an MBE for his services to music. We talked to Andrew about where his passion for music began, the meaning behind the single Cuddly Toy, who's on his bucket list to work with, and what it feels like to perform at Wembley. Welcome to the show, Andrew Roachford.
Thank you so much for coming on. We so appreciate having you on. You're just a legend. And we put it out this week saying that you were coming on, and we have had so many questions and people shocked saying, how the hell have you got Roachford on your podcast? He's brilliant. Do you know how loved you are by your fans?
I don't know if I have I don't know if I think about it that much. I mean, I know there is a lot of love out there on one level because people tell me, you know, but I'm always thinking about like the next song.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? It's like I don't fixate on that, but obviously when I do gigs and after shows, people come up to me and I realize that, you know, for artists, how your music or your work can touch people and become part of their lives, you know? And I guess, I mean, that's the real reward more than anything, is that actually your music can move people and maybe in some cases, you know, really help people get through difficult times and whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was actually looking at when you got your MBE for services to music, which is amazing. And that the Princess Royal had asked you to describe what you do. And you'd said, well, this is what it quoted in the paper that I saw. I try to evoke emotions from people through music. And I thought that was really lovely and a wonderful distillation of what it is to be a musician.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I looked for growing up was in music that I grew up listening to, is that I was not that interested in being impressed by other artists. It was about, do I resonate with this person and do they move me? You know, do they make me feel some kind of heightened emotion in some way? And then that was my gauge of, wow, that's really significant for as an artist. And when I'm writing songs, I'm writing from a standpoint of a feeling, you know. It's not as an intellectual as much thing, it's more about a feeling, because, you know, I'm a musician first before I was a singer. I was playing piano and I grew up, I did classical, went through the whole thing, but I always just got a feeling from music, you know. That's where it all started. It was like, oh, this makes me feel something, and then out of that grew the songs and the compositions. So I guess that's the kind of person I am.
Can you remember those first, that sort of first time you were affected by music?
Well, you know, how deep do you want to get? I was talking about this yesterday with a friend of mine about the first time I went to a piano, because I come from a musical family. The Roachford family are generations deep in music. So I had music in the house. My uncle, my dad, you know, were rehearsing in the living room that I grew up, live in that house, you know. And so obviously it was stimulated a lot, but there was always a piano in the building, but I never touched it. I mean, it sounds funny, but until I was like just before 4 years old. And as soon as I hit that piano, and it was really, for some reason, I got out of bed early before my parents were awake and I woke them up because I was just banging away on the piano. But I felt this connection to something. It was quite profound and I'll never forget it. And I'm not the best memory person on the planet, but there's times in your life that you really, poignant times that you really, and I remember that feeling. And it wasn't just about music, it was something that was going through me and a connection that I was making. And that was it. And my mom came downstairs and she was like, we got to get this kid some lessons, or you know, oh, he's out, because the noise was so bad. I mean, I was excuse my phone.
That's
now
okay.
I was really lost in it, but and I never looked back from then with music. That was it.
It sounds quite magical, you know. It's quite a spiritual feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe that there's a possibility that, you know, we, you know, there's other lives before we've lived or experiences and stuff. Because I never really, people ask me about songs and they go, well, where do you get the ideas from and stuff? And most artists that I know don't really know. You just sort of put yourself in the right frame of mind or feeling and these things come to you, and you can't really, it feels like it's not just you.
Yeah, we had an episode earlier in the season about talent, and we wondered about, because we were talking about whether, for example, you came from a musical family, you'd grown up with that kind of I suppose there is a discipline, isn't there, as well to music, but the fact that you were just 4 years old and could have this connection with the piano, and you go, was he a pianist in a past life? You know, I think there is something there, because that is innate talent.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it's something that you would have just, if you'd not hit the piano till you were 20, for example, you'd have still been able to play it.
Yes, brilliantly. I don't know about brilliantly, but I would have still wanted to play it. I think children are more sort of open in many ways to a lot of things, and I think as you get older, you know, and you get more, I guess, educated, your view becomes a lot narrower. So I'm not sure if I started playing at 20, because I know a lot of people that, oh, I wish I'd played piano when I was a kid. You know, as adults, they wish that they'd learned and everything, because they feel, well, you know, I've got to a stage where I don't have the time and whatever. And I do think that just the way your mind is and a lot of others, as a kid, you're more open to stuff and you're not as judgmental about yourself, you know?
Yes.
There can be a lot of feelings of shame, can't there, and pressure, and I must be good at this. And so that tends to stop people, I think, from approaching things. Well, I don't want to try that because I'll probably fail at it. When you're a child, you don't have that at all, do you? You know, you just relish everything. You just play and go for it and experience different things and feel those connections. So your parents got you piano lessons. Your mum got you the piano lessons. And how quickly was it before you sort of started composing pieces?
Quite soon, because there's another poignant moment in my life that I remember. I remember having a composition, one of my first compositions, and my mum, she got her mates to come round, and they sat all around the piano, and she goes, sing that song that you sang to me earlier. And I was singing the song, and I was just so lost in it. And then when I turned around, they were all kind of trying to hold back the laughter. And I thought, oh my God, it's not really working. And what it was is because of the lyric was, all of my life I've been searching for a wife.
Bless you.
Now, I don't know if it was just because it rhymed, or I don't know. This was my song. All of my life I've been searching for a wife. And they were just sitting there going, you're like 6 years old.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cute.
The struggle is real.
The struggle is real, man. I mean,
it's so cute.
But and my mum got me piano lessons. She was paying for a private tutor, and you know it is with kids. You know, you don't like the stuff that you have to practice over and over again. Kids want to play, and my tutor realised that I get more engaged if she says, "Well, and at the end of the lesson, you can play me your composition of the week." So that was that I always look forward to, is playing her that little piece on the piano, and I think that actually encouraged me more to you know, be creative and explore that side of myself. Yeah. You know,
was it something that came to you, or would you sit there and write the notes down, or were you composing kind of straight onto the keys, I suppose?
Straight onto the keys. I'm much more comfortable doing stuff by ear. You know, I mean, most classical musicians, there's a lot of classical musicians that they learn, obviously, sight reading, and they're very good at it and very fluid with it. But it can make the ear lazy and that side of you, because you're so used to seeing the dots in front of you. I've never been really that kind of visual person, you know. It's always composed straight into the piano. and into memory. I don't write it down.
And when you collaborate with say your band or whoever you're writing with, how does that work? Is it kind of, would it be a sort of a jamming session, or you'd play what you'd come up with and see what they wanted to add on top in terms of an arrangement, or how does that work?
Well, I mean, normally when I started out, when I was doing, when I say started out, but when I was doing demos, started doing proper demos on my little multi-track, you know, they, I, because I played multiple instruments, they came quite complete, so I could present this to my musicians and they could hear a bass line, they could hear a drum pattern and whatever. So it was always laid out that way. And if not, I could even go on the drums and say it's kind of like this, you know, and the bass goes like this. And so I just transcribed it verbally to them or played them a tape.
And so when you were little and when you were younger and you were writing, you know, composing at six, and did, you'd started singing then, is that when you discovered you'd got this incredible voice?
I didn't. Yeah, I did start singing, but it wasn't sort of like I'm a singer and I've got an incredible voice. Far from it. I just sung because it was an accompaniment to what I was playing on the piano, and because I really loved the expression. I mean, I was mostly singing in my room. I had a piano in my room, and it wasn't for public, you know, it wasn't for the public, it was for me. And that went on for many years. I just wouldn't sing, you know, incredibly shy, and singing wasn't about that. It wasn't really about performance at that point, you know. It was only a lot later that my uncle, who plays saxophone, was walking past the room and heard me singing, and he went, "I didn't know you sang." And I was like, "Well," and he was sort of, he started to encourage me to, or bully me at the time, I'll be honest. He was quite a authoritative figure, and he was like, "I think you could sing a song with my band." And I was like, "Nah, I don't think." And he was like, "Yeah, I think you can." And he meant like in a couple of days. And he taught me this song by Ray Charles called Georgia on My Mind. And I was petrified because I had to sing it with his band, get up and sing. And then, so I just closed my eyes and I just was like, this is just hell. I wasn't really enjoying it, but I sang the song. And afterwards, people started clapping. And I thought, oh, okay, wasn't that bad. And I thought maybe I got the cute kid vote as well. But then after that, started getting a bit more confidence and doing like little talent shows, local talent shows around.
Yeah, because it's something, it is something else, isn't it? That performance element. Because not every musician, singer, songwriter is able to or wants to perform. And you said you were doing talent contests. And do you have another persona? Or how do you get through that if you're kind of feeling quite shy?
Yeah, I think there's, I see two different kinds of singers that I've seen perform. Some of them get immersed in the music, some of them get immersed in themselves. I'm the person that I'm just get immersed in the music, and I'm a terrible public speaker. If I had to walk onto a stage and just talk, I'm in my worst nightmare. But if you give me music as the platform and I'm singing, then all of a sudden it's okay because I'm within that context. I don't know if that's another persona per se, but in the music, it's a different thing for me.
We were talking to a writer earlier, interviewing a brilliant Rosie Green for the podcast, and she said that that's how she expresses herself, how she organises her thoughts. And it sounds to me that the music for you is just a way of self-expression and a way of processing stuff.
Yeah. I think especially younger, you know, music helped me through a lot of the difficult times going through school and stuff. It just was like a safe place in some ways. And I think that's my connection to music, you know, it's a savior. And I think you put all of your emotions and that's how you express them, especially if you're not a very emotionally expressive person in everyday life, which I wasn't growing up again. You know, I'm like typical Aquarian, you know, it's all happening inside. But then in music, I can't hide in music. I compelled to be totally transparent in music. And I can never understand people who aren't, but I realize that for some people it's quite scary. And hence the performer person comes in. And I think that's important too. If you're that kind of artist and performer, then you should have that other person, you know. You know, we're all different.
And it sounds like from the people that are talking to you as well, that people come up to you all the time and say the effect that that's had, that authenticity in your work, that expression mm-hmm. of emotions that that people identify with, they can see themselves in it. It's a brilliant way to communicate and make other people feel seen.
I think so. I mean, it's the one thing that, you know, you walk on stage and you're looking out to a room full of strangers, you know, you don't know these people, but you're being quite transparent in front of complete strangers, and they know that. They know when it's real from when it's faked, you know. And so they open up, and there's this sort of rapport going on that you don't get walking down the street and, you know, walking to the supermarket with strangers. It's a very unique scenario where people are actually, everything is, the hearts are kind of open. I know it may sound cheesy, but that's exactly what it feels like, you know. And you asked me earlier if I know how much love is out there, but, you know, the last gig I did, I was in Glasgow. And, you know, the Scottish people, especially the Glaswegians, they're not shy at all. They're, you know, so I walk on stage and they're screaming, "Oh, we love you, Andrew." And it's not like, you know, when I started out and I was really young and there was all these teenagers throwing stuff at you. It's adults. This is a, you know, grown people. And when you hear those voices, you know it's meant. It's not meant in a cheesy celebrity worship kind of way. It's real. It's like, when else do you get that from complete strangers?
And it's because there's that vulnerability, isn't there, an authenticity in your work?
Yes, and they pick up on it, and they appreciate that you are being that honest and vulnerable in front of them. I think that's quite a big deal.
Yeah. It is a language, music, isn't it? It's a language, and it's universal, mm-hmm. which is what's so wonderful about it. I mean, I'm talking to you, it's kind of inspiring me to, because I get very nervous if I have to like sing in front of anybody. But opposite to you, if you get me up on stage to like talk or, I don't know, pretend to be a tree or whatever I'm doing with acting, I'm fine. Fine with that. Yeah. But something, I think it's because it is such a vulnerable, it's such a pure connection, I think, music, because it kind of does instantly. The only art form, I think, that absolutely instantly hits can hit you right in your solar plexus. And that's what I think there is something vulnerable. I'm just like, right, I'm gonna be more Andrew Rochford. And I just like not be embarrassed.
Yes.
Because it doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, obviously, I listen to your recordings, they are perfect, but that sense of standing up and being open. And I think people are then open back, aren't they, when you're kind of, this is me.
I mean, having said all that about, you know, how I'm more comfortable singing than talking on stage, I still get nerves walking onto the stage, like incredibly walking on in the beginning of a show. It's just like, you know, but over the years, I've realized that one of the things you have to do is to understand and silence the inner critic, because there's a lot of internal dialogue that's going on that you're not aware of actually consciously, but it's there and it's going, they're going to think this, they're going to think that. If I'm not perfect and I sing that note a bit flat, they're going to think, and it's all actually this imaginary audience that's in your head. Maybe there's someone that doesn't like what you, but you know, you need to go shut up to in that critic, and it takes a while to learn how to do that.
Do you think that's quite an important skill for young musicians to learn? Well, it's not just young musicians, is it? It's an important skill for everybody to learn, because I think we've all got that voice that sort of tells us, sort of imposter syndrome. And
yeah, the imposter syndrome, and you know, even for older artists, might never go away. You just have to learn how to live with it. But for younger artists, especially when you're starting out, it could be the make or break, because you're getting into a world that could be your career. But if you're finding it difficult with that inner critic, I mean, people say to me that, and it's true, that singing is like a big hit percent confidence. Mm. You know, as soon as you haven't got that confidence, then everything else can start falling to bits, you know. Your mind is in control of every part of your body. So if your vocal cords and everything else can't do what they're supposed to do because of your thinking, because all of a sudden now you've got tension from your thoughts, and it's like, you know, oh, the critic, oh my God.
That is not not the sort of music.
You know what? I knew that would happen. Every time I do an interview, my mum calls in the middle of it.
Oh, bless her.
Tried to call her earlier. She lives in Barbados, to sort of say, Mum, don't call me. And she was obviously at the shop and she didn't answer. And I thought, and I can't text her because she doesn't read texts. And I was like, how can I let her know not to call me? She may ring again, I'm afraid.
But you know what? I mean, I'm surprised at the theme tune, Andrew. Yeah. I mean, could you not have had something a bit more funky there?
I think it's appropriate for my mum now, you know.
Tell us about how the band came together of Rochford.
The band came together. I mean, I basically got signed as a solo artist, but I had there was a bunch of guys. I had a good friend of mine who was the bass player, but he was working with another band, and he asked me. They were doing some showcases. They were trying to get a record deal, and they said, "Could you, in the interim period, just play keyboards for us and help us get a deal and do a couple of showcases?" I joined the band to do that, and then it didn't quite work out for them. And the management were like, "Yeah, but we think you should stick with the band because they're going to be huge." And I was like, "Actually, I'm doing my own thing. I'm writing songs and everything." And the management then were very curious how I could turn down that band. And then they heard my stuff and then they ended up managing me. This is actually the Ronson family, which is Mark Ronson was a son. And the rest is history. Then I basically ended up more or less with that band being my band because basically, the bass player was a good friend of mine, so he knew all of my songs already. He was like gig ready. The drummer I loved, and it was like, well, same management ends up working me. And then we eventually found the guitarist Howie a couple of years later. And Howie was like, when he joined with my band, he was like 15 or 16, ridiculously young, but amazing, amazing guitarist, like jazz, Jimi Hendrix. I mean, it was just like, wow. And then we ended up making an album, and we called the album with these guys, and another guitarist, Michael Brown, and then went on the road, started doing the universities as you did in the white transit van. Meantime, singles going out, start hearing it on Radio 1 while you're in the van, and you realize things are changing. and then we had an album ready, but I hadn't written Cuddly Toy. Cuddly Toy wasn't on the album. And lastminute.com, I was like, well, I need another up-tempo track for the live shows, not to record. So I got the demo together. The band started playing it. It sounded amazing, and we were having fun with it. And it was like 10 minutes long, you know, because I was listening to James Brown at the time, still do. And I just loved grooving. And the band was like, what's this? No, the record company were like, what's that song that you keep playing at the end of the show that we don't have on the album? And I was like, oh, that's Cuddly Toy. And they were like, you're calling a song Cuddly Toy? And I was like, it's an in-joke about my keyboard player at the time and his really dodgy chat-up lines that always used to work. But I realized it wasn't a chat-up line. It was because he was so incredibly handsome that the girls weren't actually listening to him. And I was like, how could they fall for that line? Anyway, so they said, you need to record it. And I did. And they pulled the original album. I think it was already in the shops. Can you believe it? And we put the extra track on there, which was Cuddly Toys. So it was really the 11th hour.
Wow. Did it just go bam?
Actually not really, because it was released twice. When we first released it, it went to radio. They were Radio 1 were like, nope. They had their little meeting that they have with the producers, and they turned it down. And I remember a friend of mine now, she was what they call a radio plugger. That's the person that takes your stuff to the radio. And sadly, on that day, she just heard that her father passed away. And when they told her, oh, you know, Cuddly Toy hasn't made it to radio. And right in the foyer there of BBC, that was the last straw. And she just broke down on the floor and started crying her eyes out. And they didn't know the full story. So they're like, wow, she's really passionate about this song. Maybe you should think about it, you know. But the record company believed in it. And they were like, listen, I think at some point you need to re-release it. And we did, I think, the next year, which was 87 or 88, 88. And then completely. And then there was a girl at Capital Radio, Jackie Brambles, that she just loved it. And back in those days, there was more freedom for the DJs to play what they liked, even if it wasn't playlisted, and it wasn't played, but she kept playing it. And the audience were just like, what is this? And in the end, Radio 1 had to sort of jump on it as well, because we've been touring and everything, there was this huge buzz. And then it felt, the inertia, it just started going crazy. And then it felt like an overnight thing.
Yes, because it's funny, because people think overnight success or whatever, but you know, there's the whole lot of work goes into that. But how did that feel? Because you're quite young, all of you, at that point.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. Because it was a life-changing scenario, you know. We went from being my keyboard player, literally weeks before I wrote, I think, Cuddly Toy, literally just before I wrote it about him, left the band because he said, oh, it's not going anywhere.
Goodness.
And then I think within, I think the next year he was watching us on Top of the Pops going, oh.
And the song was about him.
That's awful. Is that sliding doors? And he didn't come back.
No, I mean, because I had to replace him, another keyboard player, bless him. And then he did get in touch with me saying, can I come back? And I was like, unfortunately, now I've got another guy. And that's just how, like you said, sliding doors, that's how your life is a product of decisions and choices that you make, you know. So all of a sudden, we were in the white transit van, as I say, playing in universities and polytechnics, and then to sort of me walking into, you know, the local Tesco's or whatever, and people just staring at me, and I was just like, okay. And I realized, oh yeah, you just do a couple of Top of the Pops appearances, and then everything is different.
Do you remember that first Top of the Pops show?
Yes, I do. I remember. I mean, you spend most of the time in the dressing room with no windows, and you know, so it's a bit like you're waiting for that call to do the camera rehearsal, and you go in and do your bit, and then you're ushered back to the. But in the meantime, it was just walking into that room that I'd been watching Top of the Pops since I was a kid. I'm like, this is the room, and you know, there were cameras around, and then all the other sort of artists that I knew at the time. I remember Mick Hucknall coming up to me and start chatting to me. I was just like, wow, that's just simply right. I mean, it was so surreal the first time, really surreal, and very exciting, because you knew that, man, this is going to be seen by, you know, not even my school teachers knew that I was doing it, and it was going to change a lot. Yes. And everything, actually.
And that it's different now, though. It's different, like, because that really, everyone did watch Top of the Pops. Yes. I mean, it must be so much harder for musician. Well, I mean, it's a hard gig anyway, isn't it? I think being a musician. But yeah, for young musicians now, they don't have that platform anymore.
It's definitely different now, completely, because there's no. It was so centralized back then, you know, when it was number one or in the top 10, everyone knew it because everyone was watching and listening to the same chart. Now I couldn't even tell you from week to week what's number five and what's number, I don't know, I haven't got a clue. And it's me in the chart. I'm not paying that much attention because I'm like, which chart are we talking about anyway? It swings and roundabouts because since the advent of the internet, you know, struggling musicians who don't have a major deal at least have a way to get their music heard on some kind of platform, which we didn't have before. It was very all or nothing. Either you had a major record deal and you were out there doing it, or you were those invisible people. So and in technology wise as well, because the main thing that I wanted to acquire from getting a record deal was the funds to be able to record in the proper studio and actually make a record. Whereas nowadays with technology, you can record something really decent, and people do, in your own living room or your own bedroom. And I think that changes the game considerably, because then it's not just for the elite people who manage to have a record deal and loads of money behind them. So it's positive. Yeah.
I remember the first one that went to number one that I can recall was that song, I Would Never Be Your Woman. White something it was called, wasn't it?
What's
and it
name?
Was number one a few years in like the early noughties.
Right.
And he recorded it in his bedroom, and that went to number one.
Or something.
Yes.
No, it wasn't White Stripes. It was white. It was a guy on his own in his bedroom.
Yes.
I would never be your woman.
Oh yeah. The Dua Lipa put on her. She took that on her, didn't she? Yeah, exactly. And now, if you say, "Oh, this album's recorded," this guy recorded this album at home in his bedroom. It's not. It was like, yeah, and.
Yeah. That's normal, isn't it? I mean, look what we're doing now. So the 80s, 90s, I don't know. The music industry was very different, wasn't it, than it is now. There was a lot more money around, I think, and that hedonism.
Yeah.
I mean, we interviewed Steve Lamack not that long ago. Yeah. And he was talking about how great he used to work at the NME. He was a journalist at the NME.
Yeah.
And it was just like people used to turn up for work at like 10 o'clock and then they'd have a 3-hour boozy lunch break. And then what was your experience of that kind of side of the music industry?
I mean, yeah, it was definitely a lot of excess going on. I mean, you know, the downside of it was that you had people working at record companies that were spending money that you had to pay back on your behalf, so to speak, inverted commas, having really expensive, I'm going to fly over to New York and and stay at the top hotel and have an expensive business lunch on your behalf to meet so-and-so from so-and-so and then fly back the next day. And you kind of go, I didn't even know that meeting was taking place. And, you know, and then giving away 100 copies of your album to their mates for free and all the merch and everything. And so there was a lot of, and then, you know, you get the bill at the end of the year and you go, what? I didn't know that you had to spend 4 days in New York talking to one guy and, you know, couldn't you have stayed in a cheaper hotel? I mean, it was really like nuts how much, and people just didn't care, you know. Did you have to fly first class? Can you, you know? And that was the way it was. And I actually was quite happy when, you know what it was? I think when hip hop came along as well, everything became a lot more, and dance music, lo-fi, and it wasn't all about the big spend. You had to be in the biggest studio spending £2,000-£3,000 a day, you could actually do it a lot cheaper and people will still go out and buy it.
We had H from Steps on last series, I think it was, and he was saying that how much that, you know, people think that you're making loads of money and raking in, but actually you have to pay for everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Steps themselves had, so he said we were very canny and we did it in a way that our videos were shot on minimum budget and we did everything in that way. And I think that was something I don't think I was clear about the music video music business, that you as the artist kind of have to pay for all of that stuff that they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think musicians now are so much more hip to that than we were. I had no idea when I was in a studio, it was like a residential studio in Oxfordshire, and I spent the whole day just with my band playing football. I didn't realise that was going to cost me like
£4,000. Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. Expensive football match.
I had no idea. And I remember we were playing it and the outside of the building was like, it was like an old church. And I wasn't that good at football and I kicked the ball and it went through the stained glass window. And obviously that became part of the bid, the budget, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And you just didn't know. And I think obviously what saved me was that I wrote all of my own songs by myself. And I think if it wasn't for that, you know, it might not be as lucrative, but because I wrote all those songs, and back then the amount of records you were selling compared to now you can have a number one selling 2,000 singles, maybe less. Back then you were selling like thousands a day, like, you know, 20,000 singles a day or something ridiculous, and you still weren't number one. It was just like completely different scale of how people consumed music. So, you know, it was swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, yeah. And so the band Roachford kicked off like in a major way. Mm-hmm. And then how many albums did you have as a band?
With those guys, yeah. With those guys, I did I 3 albums with the original lineup in total. That was the Roachford album, self-entitled Roachford.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was Get Ready, was the second album. Third album was Permanent Shade of Blue, which actually was the biggest record, I would say. By the fourth album, Feel, it was starting to sort of fray at the edges, I think, you know. The marriage had been sort of turning a bit sour. All lovely guys, all really talented. And, you know, I commend their contribution to what I was doing. But then it was kind of over from that point. So I did like 3.5 albums with that lineup, which is great. I mean, it was a great ride.
Yeah. And then in 2010, you joined Mike and the Mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Is that the right?
Yeah.
Which is another, I mean, yeah.
It was a bit later.
In your own right, you're amazing. And then they're incredible as well. Or was it a bit later, sorry?
Yeah, because it's now 2024. And it's about 2012 that I did with them, around that time anyway. And that was I just got a phone call saying, you know, Mike Rutherford would like to meet you because he's looking for a singer who's songwriter that can sort of straddle that kind of rock soul pop world, you know, and there's, I guess, not that many of them who write. And it was about doing some writing sessions together, not realizing that I was going to end up in the band.
So that wasn't the initial thing. It was just to meet with each other.
Yeah.
And then did you just find there was a chemistry between you?
I went to his house and I thought we were going to sit there at the table, talk about writing. But when I got there, he took me to his studio, sort of he has in his home, and played me some ideas. And there's me sort of humming along, just because I do, you know. And he was like, "What is that you're humming?" I was like, "Well, I'm just sort of jamming along to what I'm hearing." He's like, "It's all right if I record it." And then we just started like that. And that first meeting,
wow.
We just started recording.
Really organic. Yeah. Really organic. It just evolved. That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Yeah. And then he said to me, would you be up for sort of, you know, because I'm thinking of putting an album together and then, you know, touring this. And that's when I went, oh, hang on, this is a bit more than I thought it was going to be. And I was still obviously doing the Roachford thing, but then we realised we could make it work.
Do you prefer being in the studio writing or being on tour? Do you have a preference?
I do like being in the studio, but I've grown up gigging. I'm a gigging musician, and I think that's what I'll always be. Firstly, foremostly, as a gigging musician, and that's kind of, you know, when you're in the music business and you've got the ups and downs in the music business, that's how I can ride the wave, because what I do is I gig. I'm a gigging musician. It's not about how famous you are or you're not. You go out and you gig.
There's lots of people you've collaborated with or sung with that were like, oh, well. And I'm a bit of I've got a bit of a girl crush on Beverly Knight.
Yes.
Who, for a start off, she's a Midlands gal like us.
Yes.
So that's,
yes.
But also she's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And the song that you duetted with her is amazing. How did that connection come about?
You know what, over the years, as you do, I've always been crossing paths, bumped into Beverly here, you know, at this festival here, at this gig here, and always said to her, yeah, we should do something together. And it was, you know, people say talk is cheap and whatever. And then one day she covered Cuddly Toy and released it, and it was all over the radio again. And it was like, wow, she's kind of changed it and made it her own. And it got even more attention from me, like, wow, this girl. And then when I was in the studio on doing my album before, we had this song that we were writing, and we thought, this has got to, you know, me and the producer and the co-writer, this has got to be a duet. He's like, well, who's going to sing the girl part? And straight away, obviously, her name, you know, being it was a soul track as well, really soulful. And, you know, I didn't want, you know, some random session singer. It needed to be someone who really could put a heartfelt lyric across.
Yeah.
Got in touch with her, and straight away she was just like, I'm there. And of course, she came to the studio, and in a couple of takes, it was just like, okay. We're all sitting there going, yeah, she completely nailed it.
She's so powerful, isn't she?
She's phenomenal.
I just think she's incredible. She's got so much power behind her voice and soul.
It's a natural duet you guys, because that that straddling of the different genres, I think Beverly is also very able to do that. So it's a fantastic track. I love it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I was so chuffed to get her on it, and what she did on that track is legendary. And you know, and she loved it as well. That's the thing, is that she really was feeling that track, you know.
Is there anybody that you'd like to collaborate with that you haven't collaborated with yet?
And I mean, I've got this sort of bucket list thing, which some of it I've left it so late that the people I don't even know if they're still performing, but I would have, and still maybe, you know, Al Green has always been someone that I would have liked to write for, because I relate to that gritty, earthy Southern soul thing, you know, and I feel like I, oddly enough, even though as far south as I come from is South London, but Americans from that part of the world say, you sound down home, which means you sound like you're from here. And how is that possible? I don't know. I mean, I'm going out soon to Nashville to do some writing and maybe go to Memphis and try and you know, is that my people? But I'd like to do that. And, you know, I do love Adele. I love people that I believe when they sing. That's, you know, I'd love to do something with her. And she's not just a singer. She's obviously an artist, you know, she's a creative artist. Love to do that. There's a guy called PJ Morton, who's an American rhythm and blues R&B soul artist in with a very strong Stevie Wonder influence, and of course Stevie would be the pinnacle for me. I've learned so much from Stevie Wonder musically and, you know, spiritually even. I mean, he's such an incredible human being, really.
Would you, I mean, you could write something, couldn't you, and send it to Al Green's people or Stevie's people?
Oh, yeah.
I think you should do it.
I think it's just down to, end of the day, it's, your limitations are down to you, you know.
Yeah.
Because actually I know I worked with this guy, well, jammed with this guy, a drummer. He works with a band called The Roots, you know, and they were a really unknown. They actually lived in London many years ago, and no one even knew who they were. I mean, and who would know that then in years to come he would end up producing an Al Green album? He produced an album for Al Green, you know, and I know this guy. So it's like, oh, wow, he got that gig, you know. But his self-belief, I mean, you have to have that thing and not think it's too big, you know, because you say things to people, I like to work with Stevie Wonder and it sounds like grandiose, but actually, you know, someone like me, I would have something, especially with Al Green as well, to offer them. It's not just like, I want to work with Al Green. I feel like I really have studied his musicality and everything that he does, and I feel like I could bring something to the table. I actually knew someone that was working with him, and at the time she's trying to put me off because she said it was a bit eccentric, you know, and I was like, oh, but now I think, well, eccentric and, you know, not like I'm not. So there we go.
Yeah. I've realised that as I get older, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm an actor. That means I can be eccentric. I'm going to be a crazy lady, and I can go, but I'm an actor, guys. It's totally, I think we're entitled to it.
Yeah. But it often helps, doesn't it?
It does help.
We've had so many questions from people, like I said at the beginning, and the first question I want to ask you about is your MBE from my friend Hazel, actually, who I knew was a fan of yours, because during lockdown she sent to me and a whole gang of us you and Gary Barlow singing Cuddly Toy, and she said, oh my god, guys, if you need something to get you through, watch this. And she's told me she said she sort of feels that helped to get through. She just loved it, and she adores you and she adores your work, and it is so uplifting, that performance you did with Gary. It's just, there's something, I will get to her question, but there's something about, in particular, the song Cuddly Toy as well, all of your music, but that song, it still feels very current. It stands the test of time. It gets everybody on the dance floor. It sort of my whole body starts moving without much thought. It just goes. It really speaks to people.
I actually think all your music is very It's kind of timeless, I think.
Yeah.
Because if I think, well, the Cuddly Toy you wrote in the 80s. Well, yeah. if I had never heard that, I wouldn't have gone, that's an 80s song. I'd say, oh, that was what came out last year.
Yeah.
So there is that. Yeah.
Yes. Definitely.
Your music will be listened to in thousands of years and they'll think it's
from Mars. From Mars.
Yes.
Hazel would like to know about your MBE, how it came about, who gave it to you, and what the experience was like.
What it was about was I got an MBE for contributions to music, and I was at home, got a letter through the door literally, and was just like, well, you know what, it looks so official that I was scared to open it. I thought, this is another bill, or I went through a red traffic light, and I actually left it there for a couple of days. And then I remembered, oh, that letter. And when I opened it and it was really official, I was thinking, I must owe someone a lot of money. And then I started reading it and it was just, oh, wow. I mean, didn't see that coming, you know? And of course I accepted. And then we, you know, fast forward early the next year, I was going into Buckingham Palace with my mum and my brother and my cousin, you know? And it was a very, I can't even find the words, but it was a very special, special occasion. Sadly, my brother passed away like weeks after that. But he was my manager and he was a big part of my life and even my band and everything. And so for him to see that as well, it was more about that to me than anything, even me getting it. It was just like, I felt like he was part of the reason why I've achieved what I've achieved in this journey for life. You know, and Princess Anne, Princess Anne, thank you very much. You know, it's part of life, isn't it? Princess Anne was the one that gave me the medal, and it was quite nerve-wracking because I was waiting in the wings and then they call you and it's like, not something I do every day. And the orchestra's playing and oh my God. And she started engaging in conversation, which I thought she'd just like pin something on you. But she's, you know, she's really good because she's obviously done it a few times before. It was almost like we were having a normal conversation about being on the road and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, this is surreal.
So nice. And your mum must have been so proud.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, my mum is from Barbados in the Caribbean, and she was a, you know, British colony, and the Queen and the royal family was, and especially still is, to my mum's generation, everything. I mean, any accolades coming from that part of of the society means so much to all of my mum's friends and everything. So can you imagine when she went back to Barbados, you know, having been at Buckingham Palace, you know, they were all like, you know, and some of them in the early days when I was getting into music as a career was saying, oh, you're making a mistake letting your son, you know, do music as a career because nothing's going to happen, because people will say that because they don't know. But my mum was always like, Andrew is going to be a musician, whether I want him to or not. And she did want me to, but it was like, she knew that was my destiny. So again, there was more, you know, she was right. And there she had that accolade as well for herself.
Yeah. And she can dine out on that for years. That's a great, isn't it? It's a great kind of mic drop.
Exactly. You know, how many people get to really, you know, to do that and to go to Buckingham Palace and do that? And I didn't take it as any light thing. I was so honored. And, you know, I don't really write songs for that, you know, for awards and that kind of accolade. I write songs because I can't not write them. But, you know, that was something, and the timing of that was quite special.
That's amazing. How wonderful. I'm so glad you're, well, it's lovely that all your family there and that your brother got to see that. It must have been quite a moment for him as well. Really special.
Oh man, he looked so proud. He looked like vindicated, and it's like, wow.
That's wonderful. You know. Mary asks, looking back across your career to date, which moment has been the biggest buzz and gives you a tingly feeling when you think back to it?
I still often get people come up to me going, when you opened for INXS at Wembley Stadium, we were there. And I feel like everyone was there because I get that. The gig I go to.
We were there, weren't we, Suze? We were there.
And I remember walking out onto that stage, it's Wembley Stadium, you know, and it was packed. And I think I'd seen, might have been Freddie Mercury's performance, Radio Gaga, and I thought, well, see if I, beginning of the first song, get people clapping and see what that looks like, you know? And when you do it and all those hands go up, that's something, you know, that was like my first big major gig. And it was like, wow, they are all listening and all engaged right now. And that was nuts. And my mum was there as well. And she was a few seats down. There were Elton John was there. And Elton John was just raving about me. And he was talking to the record company going, you need to work on this guy because he's this and he's that. And you know, what another, that was a goose pimple moment for me, definitely. I mean, I met Stevie Wonder as well a couple of times. And that's like meeting, I don't know, I mean, he is just the biggest hero for me forever. So just meeting him was crazy, surreal. Mm-hmm. Really surreal.
So great to have that, those memories, isn't it? And because it kind of does, I don't know, having a really great memory, especially of meeting a hero or having that amount, the adrenaline you must have felt,
yes,
and that the energy, yes, coming off those people, it kind of, yeah, keeps you going in a way, doesn't it? Gives you a little, yes, a little burst when you remember it. That's really, yeah, great. Oh.
I mean, you know, even today when I play gigs, there's times when you're touring and it's in the winter and it's raining and it's cold and damp, and you just think, oh, I've got to get off the bus and go and do a gig. And maybe sometimes you're just not feeling motivated. You walk onto that stage and the energy hits you, and all of a sudden, this is it. This is why I'm doing this. You know, this is the energy. This is the energy that you can't quantify it or get it anywhere else. This exchange of energy is so special.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. Not from a Wembley Stadium volume of people, but yeah. Just, well, I suppose, know, any performance really, isn't it? Any,
yeah, time. I mean, I've done really, like, I'll do like tiny venues, and I'm also still, you know, doing big venues. I'm doing festivals, Isle of Wight a couple of years ago, and then obviously performing with Mike as well. It's the same thing, really. It's about that exchange of energy with the other human beings.
Yes,
yeah,
wonderful thing.
I'm very conscious that we're coming up to time and that you're going to have to go. So, and a lot of the other questions that I have written down, we've
kind, yes, of, or no answers. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. It's been such a joy. You have such a lovely, calm energy about you, and you're clearly so.
Likewise.
Thank you. You're obviously so connected to your music, and it's a really authentic, truthful, honest thing, and I think that's why you're so beloved by so many people. And it's,
plus you write
really
absolute bangers.
Yes, you do.
Thank you.
If I'm at a wedding and Cuddly Toy comes on, there is not one seat, not one person on their bottom. They're all up the dance floor.
And so, I did just want to say about Cuddly Toy, because I know you revisited it on the your latest album, and I was like, my God, is this is even more kind of I don't know how you've managed it, but you've kind of taken it even up a notch.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been performing it for a while now.
But it's just, I was like, could it get any more kind of, like, you know, but because I suppose your voice changes every,
yes,
time a little bit.
Your voice does. Your voice changes. You change physically and also emotionally. You've gone through a journey which comes out in your voice. And yeah, I perform at the gigs. You've got to come to the gig because it's another level again when you hear it live. It's just another thing.
Well, we would love to. I mean, have you got any coming up that we can kind of put out about, shout about?
Well, I'm at the moment, I'm putting, well, my management are putting dates together. So I would say watch this space. I'll be doing European dates first, because I've just done, last year was a really busy year for me in the UK, and I just finished at Christmas. So I don't think I'll be doing any major tours, but there'll be sporadic dates, a few festivals that will go on my Insta, my website and whatever. Yeah. So just watch this space, really. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, we will be there when we can. The next one we can get to. Be great, yes, to see you.
So at Rochford Music on the Insta. Yes.
Yeah, we'll put that on.
Thank you so much. It's been even better than I expected it would be. So wow. Thank you for giving us your time. Yeah, really kind of you.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It was even better than I thought it would be.
Oh, yeah. Good.
No, you guys are really lovely to sort of talk with, and it's easy. You know, I feel relaxed and just have a chat. You know, it's not.
Oh, that's really boring. Kind. Take care. Have a lovely, lovely care. Afternoon.
Enjoy the rest of the day. Thanks, Andrew.
Ciao. Bye. Bye.
This week, we asked you, like our lovely listeners, what are your fondest memories of the 1980s? And we were awash with responses. It was so lovely. And it sparked so many memories.
It did. And I was surprised at how old all our listeners actually are.
When we are mere chitter for girls. We were only 12. I don't
remember the 80s at all, Esther.
Wasn't there. Made it all up. I'll start. So our first comment is from Seth, who posted a lovely picture of a rally bike in front of a Christmas tree and said that was his best Christmas ever. And he also sent an image of a woman doing aerobics, which makes me think of Lizzie from... Was it Lizzie on Good Morning GMTV or Good Morning Britain?
Oh, I remember Rosemary Conley.
Oh, yes. And there was Lizzie on... Oh, no, TVAM, maybe.
Anyway, and Mr. Motivator was at the 90s.
Mr. Motivator was the 90s. I saw him a couple of years ago at Camper Calling. He was brilliant. In his 60s. Looked amazing. A lot of my friends were like, I would.
Well, yes. Okay, so the next one I've got is from Ian on Instagram, who's did a little gif of a Transformer. Robots in disguise.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They were everywhere, weren't they?
Of Saturday morning cartoons.
Emma Knight on Facebook. 80s always makes me smile when I think of them. Care Bears to My Little Pony, watching Grange Hill after school, and Blue Peter. Posters of Ball Young, Wham, and Michael J. Fox on my wall too. Definitely happy, happy times.
It is.
It's so lovely.
And we've got a lovely one here from Jan, who it says, in 1984 to 85, I travelled from Canada with my backpack, plus maple leaf patch, of course, to Great Britain. So Jan is actually in Canada.
Wow.
International listeners. And she travelled to Great Britain, Europe, New Zealand and Australia with stopovers in unique countries like New Caledonia and Tahiti. Lots of photos, stories to tell of meeting wonderful people and seeing fabulous sights. It was unforgettable. And she says, looking forward to your show. Thanks, Jan.
Oh, thank you, Jan.
I want to see some photos. I want to see some pics of that 1984 to 85 trip.
Yeah, amazing. Jolene Howell said, loved our childhood in the 80s. Life seemed so much simpler then. Saturday night TV with the family, going to choose a video from the rental shop, playing on my bike in the street on a Sunday and smelling Sunday roasts being cooked, going into town with my pocket money and buying a six-inch record and playing it non-stop. Always seeing aunties and uncles and playing with cousins. Oh, that smell
so
of
lovely.
A Sunday roast while you're playing outside. That is a really strong image for me, actually, of the 80s as well.
So great, not having to cook.
Yeah, yes.
Kids don't know they're born.
They don't.
we do. Right, we've got one from Rachel Fox here. Madonna breaking onto the music scene with lace gloves. I mean, yeah, she's just still an icon. Jelly shoes, cutting your feet to shreds.
Jelly shoes,
still do that to my kids. And bags where your pens fell out. Yes, those kind of army bags that we used to have and draw all over. Some of the best music. Yes, still the best music. Live Aid, and other odd fashions like rah-rah skirts and pedal pushers. I think I'm still in pedal pushers. I've given up with the rah-rah skirts.
Yes. Sue Hawkins, are you ready? She said, this is quite an extensive list. Wanting to marry Matt from Bros, much prefer Luke these days. Wanting to be Madonna, the music in general, house parties, Grange Hill, leg warmers, Flashdance, Fame, film and TV show, having a boombox and taking it over the park and playing Frankie by Sister Sledge, really loud, hashtag cool, playing over the park, Innocence, getting drunk on half a can of Tennent Super, playing over the tip without fear of catching a disease, and no social media, which equals no evidence of underage drinking.
Yes, just in our own memories. Lovely Hayley, who's one of our patrons, says simply, Bros.
Yes.
Absolutely. They were the first kind of, I don't know, mega boy band in my memory, really. Apart from the Beatles, obviously. but for our age group.
Yeah. Did you have the grunge things on your shoes?
I didn't.
Yeah, I did. I loved them.
You were obviously much cooler than me.
Heather Jackson, why don't you on weekend mornings, pixie boots and neon rah-rah skirts, stonewashed denim and Nick Berry's Every Loser Wins? Jermaine Stewart's You Don't Have to Take Your Clothes Off, classic tune. Yeah. And what I'd give to go back, I'd wear that rah-rah skirt every day.
No, you just do it. Just do it anyway.
Just do it.
Now, Harriet Carmichael says, I'm way too young to remember.
Like us?
I'm not saying anything, Harriet. Not saying anything.
Heather Roberts said, I loved going to In Touch to spend my pocket money on stickers. There were big rolls and my sister and I would collect them in a photo album. They were never actually used. I remember the winter that the BBC showed their adaptation of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe on Sunday afternoons and it being so magical. Oh God, I remember that. I loved it.
I had such a crush on Sam West, who was Prince Caspian.
Oh, yes.
I've still got a crush on him purely because of that.
We sometimes dig that out and watch that on a Sunday afternoon. It's so magical. The sweet smell of my strawberry shortcake dolls and playing with my flower fairy dolls. Reading the Brambley Hedge books. Yeah, I love those.
Yes.
I remember desperately longing for my child doll with an adorable button nose. The smell of Lametta on Christmas trees. I don't know what Lametta is.
Is
it the sort of the almost like tinsel that hangs down? We had that.
I don't know.
And the deliciousness of the Cadbury tree decorations wrapped in colourful foils. I also adored the Worst Witch film, so 80s. Yes, the Worst Witch.
Yes, I've actually still got all the Brambley Hedge books.
Me too.
And I should have got my flower fairies out as well. I've got two flower fairies.
I never had a flower fairy.
They are very cute.
I've always wanted pretty, one. Sue, what's happened?
Oh, well, I know what to get you for Christmas. Emma Hastings says roller boots, Walkmans, Care Bears.
Oh yes,
it's totally. Like that's three. What's that thing where you can find somewhere?
Oh,
three words.
When you're lost.
Yeah. The three words: roller boots, Walkmans, Care Bears.
She's down at Spa in Birmingham.
It's the Lidl. That's so funny. You said the Spa, and I thought Lidl.
Did you?
Yes. Oh God.
Okay. Gail Crampton said, first job in hairdressers, and hair was big. Discovering Birmingham, the Dome, Pagoda Park, Bobby Brown's, etc. Some of the best music: Wham, The Pet Shop Boys, Erasure, Prefab Sprout, Deacon Blue, Eves and Christopher's American in Wallheath. I don't know those places, but I recognise all the rest of it. Just fab. Yes. And she sent us a brilliant picture of her with massive, massive hair, which looks amazing.
One of the gang from All About the Archers podcast has put chocolate spread sandwiches.
Oh, wow.
Delicious.
Delicious. Lucy Smith said, Saturday Superstore and number 73. Yep. Sandy Toksvig on, and that girl on roller boots, Andrea Arnold. Was on roller boots and watching telly all Saturday morning, roller skating, playing out in the street with the other kids till dinner time. Sweets, for example, Pacers, which I loved. The smell of the ink on the printouts for school homework, that weird purple stuff. My Little Ponies, Whizbit, Kickstart, Grange Hill, SodaStream, never allowed one. Slingback shoes, also never allowed. No, me neither. Birthday parties with Agadoo and the Superman song.
Oh, yes. I was at a party the other day, kids' party, and they played that. They played
Did they have the Superman song or Agadoo?
Yes. Spray.
Brilliant. Calm the air. Spray.
Muscle Man.
Yeah.
Macho Man.
Yeah. So good.
Oh, so Steph, lovely Steph, who contributes regularly, has said strawberry shortcake, the cartoon and the doll, collecting pencil rubbers which smelled white musk perfume from the body shop.
Yes.
That always reminds me of my stepmum. That was my stepmum's.
Oh my God, my stepmum wears white musk and I buy her some every year from the body shop.
Oh my goodness.
That's so weird. John Wood. Last one for me. Seeing great bands including U2, Michael Jackson, Madonna, Duran Duran, Deacon Blue, and I even saw Roachford supporting Terence Trent D'Arby, also playing in a band. And also, he said, great films, The Brat Pack, Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink, St Elmo's Fire, plus Star Wars sequels, Back to the Future, Top Gun, Ghostbusters, Beverly Hills Cop, Dirty Dancing, Roadhouse, Big, Goonies. I could go on, he said.
Oh, you could, but we'd be here all day.
We would.
Oh, John, I loved all those. And I've got one here from another regular contributor. Thank you, Sarah Scott, who says, being able to sit in the footwell of my nan's metro car and play board games on the back seat with my sister on long journeys, because seatbelts were a bit of a choice then.
They were, weren't they?
They were.
thank you for sending all those in, guys. They've all, I can remember all of those things. And yeah, fab, weren't the 80s days?
So lovely. It's just lovely memories that I'd forgotten loads of those things. So thank you so much for sending those in and joining in. And it's just great to know you're listening. Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
You have been listening to Limited Time Only.
Well, that was an absolute joy to talk to Andrew Rochford about his career and about the very essence of being a musician and the communication. And I just loved it. I feel really inspired.
I feel really inspired and really calm. He's such a calm presence. My nervous system, oh, it's lovely. He's such a lovely, lovely, genuinely thoughtful, inspiring, and like you say, insightful man. So thank you so much for coming on, Andrew Rochford. Mm-hmm. How exciting.
Thank you, Andrew Rochford. I know. What's happened to
us? Who are we?
Yes, thank you to Andrew, and thank you to you all for listening and coming with us on this fantastic journey of discovery every 2 weeks. We love it.
Yes, thank you. And thank you to our patrons over on Patreon. If you do want to support us, if you come over there, go to patreon.com and type in Limiting Time Only Podcast, and you can subscribe to us.
If you join us on Patreon, there's bonus content over there, and we will soon be doing our third Limited Time Only Live online, which is an exclusive party, basically, on Zoom.
It certainly is. So thank you again for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks. Take care, everybody.
Take care.
Lots of love.
Right, I'm going to go and listen to some Rochford. Absolute bangers. So you gotta feel for me, baby.
Feel for me, baby.
Yeah, you gotta feel for me, baby.
Feel for me, baby.
Yeah, you gotta feel for me, baby.
Feel for me, baby.
Give me some love.